Schultz realized that he was dyslexic when his son Eli was diagnosed with the condition in second grade. Schultz wrote recently in the New York Times that when he was his son's age, he had already given up on himself. When he was in school, he was held back and expelled, relegated to the dummy class, teased and shunned by his classmates, and largely ignored by his teachers. Schultz didn't learn to read until he was 11 and has since gone on to become a respected poet who won a Pulitzer Prize a few years ago. His new book is called My Dyslexia, and it's about how he struggled with his learning disability, learned to overcome it, and even use it to his advantage. And he joins us from the NPR studios in New York. And Philip Schultz, what a pleasure, and thank you for writing this book.
Well, thank you, Marty. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you here. And I have to begin with the title because I just I thought it said so much about you, which is My Dyslexia. How do you think about your dyslexia today?
Well, I think about it, I guess, almost all the time because it's out there in a way that I never dreamed it would be, and talking about it and talking to people, other people who suffer from it, and understanding it more. The title came from a commencement speech I was asked to give at the Churchill School for Learning Disabled Students 2 years ago, and I just wrote a small piece, and it seemed like the appropriate title, and an editor, my editor, got a hold of it and thought I should write a book called that. So I can't really take credit for it.
Fair enough. And I so enjoyed so much of the book. And you also write about this graduation. And as you said, these were kids that had learning disabilities. And as they came up on stage to get their diplomas, a great deal of positive, you know, enthusiasm, and one kid gives you a big hug and says, "You're part of the family. You're part of our family now." What did that mean to you?
Well, I was very surprised by it, and it meant a great deal. I was feeling very awkward. Like, here, there was the principal and the president and the head of the teachers and the PTA, and they were all warmly embracing the students. I could tell that this was quite an accomplishment for them, that I had never seen a school like this. I frankly didn't even know that they existed. And I felt like something of an imposter in being there. Who was I to give them any advice? I knew something about my son having dyslexia, but I really, it had been 2 years since I understood now that I had it. I wasn't officially diagnosed. I didn't understand. I didn't really spend a lot of time thinking about it. It explained the past, but that was the past. And suddenly I was busy being a prize-winning poet and giving reading. So when he grabbed me and said that, it made me understand and think about that I maybe had something to say. I could maybe reach out to others.
But do you feel part of that community?
Well, much more now. I mean, I'm getting letters and people are going out of their way to tell me their life stories. I'm getting these letters, and it's terribly moving. And one of the impressions I'm getting is that I'm not the only one out there who put the past, the difficult past, behind me and didn't think about it and just made my way forward, that there's all these others who have these stories of being bullied and being ostracized and terrible isolation and feeling worthless, having, you know, the sense of self that they've had to live despite, around.
Well, you are a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, and I know what a prestigious award that is. I also know how hard it is to be a poet, especially in this country. Do you find that there's more interest in your dyslexia than in your poetry?
Well, that's very interesting. That's a great question, frankly. I had no idea. I had the writing of the book seemed, well, okay. It took me a long time to decide to do it. Almost everything in it I discovered while writing it. I didn't know, for instance, that my method of teaching writing that I teach in the school comes right out of my dyslexia, that it comes right out of the way I finally taught myself after everyone had given up on trying to teach me how to read, how I taught myself. So all this was absolutely new. But I am at times feeling that I'm being cast, and I'm not an expert. I'm right. far from an expert. I'm not a scientist. I guess I know something about my life. I'm an expert in my life and how to articulate it, perhaps. But I am, you know, I think the poet in me is beginning to wonder, scratch its head, and wondering what's going on here. I mean, does anyone care about the poetry? I mean, is this...
Well, we are going to have you read some poetry during the show.
Okay, well,
I absolutely promise.
The poet will thank you very much.
But let me go back to the dyslexic part of you.
No one's asked that question before, so that's
good. Oh, good. I search for those questions that no one has ever asked, and sometimes they're hard to find.
Well, you got one there.
Well, there you go. But I'm interested because your son was diagnosed with dyslexia in second grade. And was
yes.
was this an aha moment for you? I mean, did you feel like you had seen perhaps things in your son that you had seen or remembered in yourself as a child or maybe even as an adult? And did you think, oh, my goodness, maybe that's me?
I couldn't speak. I was stunned. Yeah, my wife... and I were sitting there in the neuropsychologist's office. She had done all these tests, and she was giving us the results. And she was going through the symptoms, which I already knew something about, but I just never put it together. And she was listing them all, and word retrieval, the difficulty with that, the ability to be distracted, the role that anxiety plays, not... you know, coordination, and I was just, oh my God, it explained everything. You know, when you're confronted with much more information than you can possibly absorb, and I know that dyslexics, in any case, given the way our brains are wired, wired, that we disconnect from the anxiety that the surprise causes. And that's, I just sat there silently, like it was obvious that this was my case, too. And then I began speaking to her at length, Dr. Simer, at length. And it was clear that this explained being thrown out of two schools, not being able to read until I was 11 in the fifth grade, the dummy class, it explained everything. Explained everything and nothing.
And I actually understand exactly what you're saying there, but let me read something that you described about reading for you, and I'll just read a couple of sentences. The act of translating what for me are the mysterious symbols of communication into actual comprehension have always been a hardship for me. I often read a sentence two or three times before I truly understand it, must restructure its syntax and sound out its syllables before I can begin to absorb its meaning and move on to the next sentence. So it sounds like every sentence for you, you are in a sense sort of translating as if it were a foreign language.
Well, that would be a very interesting, I'd say a good analogy, except that dyslexics can't learn foreign languages.
I understand that, yes.
They're an incredible ordeal. So, yes, I love everything about reading except the act itself. Mm-hmm. And friends now who send me their books for me to read and comment on now understand why they don't hear from me for so long, especially if it's in prose, that I have to read. It's a competition reading because it's better when I'm fresh, and that's when I write.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm tired at all, I will read the same sentence over and over and not get anything from it. I actually see marks, black marks on a white page. And there are moments when they're unintelligible.
They're just black
marks. I just can't put them together. The difference is, I mean, and this is an enormous difference. I know what it is now, and I'm calm about it, and I wait. There was a time, many times in my life, when I didn't know what it was, and I would panic. And, of course, that didn't help things.
Well, you describe reading comic books with your mother at night, and as you said, you taught yourself to read. Was it through comic books then?
Yes. I mean, I, I couldn't be held back again. I mean, I was in the toughest school already, and there was reformatory, or there was no school, so we were all desperate. And this tutor I was going to see wasn't a retired principal, wasn't making any progress with me. And the only thing I seemed to be interested in, I didn't know from, you know, children's books, and was comics. I would look at the pictures. I would avoid the dialogue bubbles. And out of desperation, certainly my mother's desperation, she would read the words aloud, and I would try to identify them. And I created a little boy, finally. It was really a dead end. I had to, or it was really give up. So I created a little boy who could read, and I tried to imagine what he would feel about that, the satisfaction, what life would be like, and how he did it. And I would start by sound, repeating the sounds. And after a time, and I use the word magically because it isn't, it's neurological, my brain was able to identify the marks on the page with sounds, recognize them in the most rudimentary, basic, primitive way. And but there was some excitement because I was being able to recognize, you know, a few words here and a few words there, and after a while I was reading.
I mean, it's so creative. By what you created a character for yourself who was yourself, who could read.
Right.
And didn't have the kind of anxiety that the non-reading self had about reading.
I wanted to be him. I wanted to be anybody but me. I wanted to be this kid who was, quote-unquote, normal, like all the other kids, like the kids who found me hysterically funny and different. And I created him, and I became him, at least in my fantasy world, and he was a reader. So I taught myself how to read, and
we're almost up in a break here. Does he still exist, or is he now part of you?
He's there. Somebody asked me recently for a photo of me as a young boy for some show on TV or whatever, and I found these pictures of what I think is a rather depressed looking little kid.
Oh, no.
Wow, that, and it said it to me that is, I think that was maybe around, that was probably just before he could read. There was a look of alarm and distress.
Well, let's take that very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Our guest is Philip Schultz. He's a Pulitzer Prize winning poet, and he's also the author of a slim and fascinating new book. It's called My Dyslexia. Stay with us. We're going to take a very short break. Lines also open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Bristol Riverside Theater proudly supports WHYY and presents Cheetah Rivera, My Broadway, September 23rd through 25th. Tony Award winner Cheetah Rivera performs songs from musicals such as America from West Side Story, Big Spender from Sweet Charity, All That Jazz from Chicago, and more. Four performances only, September 23rd to the 25th at Bristol Riverside Theater. For tickets, brtstage.org or 215-785-0100.
Next time on APM SymphonyCast, we're at the BBC Proms, where music enthusiasts queued up early to get a prime spot to hear one of the best ensembles in the world, the Philadelphia Orchestra. Hi, I'm Allison Young. It's one of our own playing in London with music that was written just for them. That's coming up on APM SymphonyCast.
Sunday night at 8 on WHYY.
Hi, I'm Mike McGrath, inviting you to join us later today for a very special web chat at whyy.org/garden@high noon. We'll discuss everything you need to know about fall planting, garlic, pansies, lawn care, composting, and more. That's today at noon at whyy.org/garden.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Maz Cohen, talking with poet Philip Schultz. In fact, he won the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry for a collection of poems called Failure, winning the 2008 Pulitzer Prize. He's also the author of other books of poetry, and he's got a new memoir called My Dyslexia. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And this is the experience of dyslexia, as I would say, from the inside out. Philip Schultz, you got into a lot of fights when you were kids, when you were a young kid. Were you picked on because you didn't do well in school? Were you a target because there was something about your dyslexia, even though you weren't diagnosed with that as a kid?
Well, now I understand that that's clearly the case. I think then I just felt picked on. It got really intense in third grade when I couldn't read. The kids were probably reading from second grade and some in first, and I was being ostracized, and I remember there being a lot of laughter. I remember thinking that I didn't know what multiplication tables were. I thought that meant a lot of tables, multi-tables.
Like actual tables, right?
Yeah, I really, really, my terror of learning, and I couldn't listen to the teacher. After a while, it would, because of word retrieval issues and distraction, it's hard in auditory processing. Sometimes you don't hear the first part of a sentence, and by the time you catch on and begin to make sense of it, the teacher has gone on to the third or fourth or a new idea. So the embarrassment of this, and I lived in terror of being called upon, would get to the point where I would stop listening. Therefore, I learned nothing. I didn't learn anything. Math was all a jumble. So I would be made fun of. And this was the inner city in Rochester. It was a tough immigrant neighborhood. And I didn't like being bullied. And we lived with my father and my uncle, and they were tough guys in a certain way, and movies, and so I handled it the way I thought I had to, and it, of course, only made everything worse. I got kicked out of school.
Well, this was back in the 1950s, there weren't these diagnoses that we use today to help describe kids like you.
They didn't know. They really didn't know. These poor teachers who had huge classes. They were not special ed. If it existed, it didn't exist. I don't think they knew that there was such a thing as dyslexia. They were just learners and non-learners and slow kids, and I was seen as a slow kid. But in my new school, I was put at a table with two others, and it was called the dummy table by the other kids. And by then, I had just accepted this role, that I was stupid. And it's quite a, that word, I have a very mixed relationship with that particular word.
Does it still hurt today?
Yes. I mean, not always, but sometimes I will. It depends at the angle I associate it, I come at it. Like, it brings to mind, I was a young English teacher at Tufts once. I was in my 20s. It was one of my first jobs. And I remember there was somebody in my class who was struggling. And a composition, English composition, nothing fancy. And other kids were giving him, other young people, they were in their 20s or 19, and were giving him a hard time, or 18. And I called him aside one day, and I said, well, you know, because his papers were not legible, and he obviously had. And he said, I'm dyslexic. And I didn't know what the word meant. I'm just now remembering this. Mm-hmm. I remember, and he started to say, what it was, and how he had to have a special tutor, and that someone in the dean's department would discuss this with me and help him. And I remember just thinking afterwards that, boy, that's weird. I mean, God, what an interesting word. Boy, some of this feels a little familiar.
You didn't run to the dictionary at that point. There probably wasn't Google then, right? You didn't run to the dictionary?
I did just the opposite. I ran away from the word. I encountered it again in my life for many, many, many years. I didn't want to bring up 95-98% of what I wrote in this book all came up during the writing, and I would never, of my own volition, go near it or ask it to be brought up. I mean, it's great that it has, and it's certainly a way of, opening the cellar door and disbanding all the ghosts and making it less frightening. But
well, you describe being in many ways an isolated child, but at this dummy table, as you call it, you did make a friendship with a kid named Billy. And I have to say, this, page and a half that you wrote about Billy is just lovely. And I was wondering if you could read that for us.
Sure.
Page 62.
I have it right here.
Okay.
But Billy didn't seem to mind being seen this way. In fact, he took it as a compliment. This is our being in the dummy class. Since it was obvious that we knew things the others didn't, like how to breathe through our ears and make firecrackers out of Drano and Epsom salt, they were the real dummies. He named us after popular TV Western stars. He was Pancho the Moron, while I was Cisco Kid Idiot. We invented a secret three-fingered handshake and a way of pronouncing words by half-whispering, half-swallowing them. A secret guttural language consisting of grunts and whistles for and by morons. We kidded each other about who was more stupid and who had the worst father. His, a toothless, overweight, drunken night shift janitor at DuPont's who lived with someone Billy claimed was a professional prostitute, won hands down. His younger brother, Ronnie, who put on shows for us wearing her hats and underwear, claimed he knew more about sex than anyone in the Finger Lakes, and proved it by going on to becoming a cross-dressing teenage prostitute. We spent a good deal of time playing hooky, stealing cans of soup, spaghetti, peaches, and candy bars from Levy's grocery, capturing butterflies in jars, and looking at his father's enormous collection of nudist magazines. I was never sure what Billy liked about me, but I admired his fearless tenacity and headlong appetite for adventure and bravado. He was my one friend, the only one I can remember having in grade school or high school. His belief in embracing one's position in the world as an honor bestowed upon the chosen and select, no matter how low or disposable, is an idea I still hold dear. It was a position in ours. Our friendship, I imagined, was the kind soldiers forged in a war, a bond born of survival, familiarity, and mutual respect. His attitude was that our being placed at the dummy table was a position and bond of privilege. I was saddened to hear, many years later, after I left for college, that Billy had joined the army and was killed in Vietnam.
That's a beautiful passage, and that's our guest, Philip Schultz, reading from his new book called My Dyslexia. And thank you, first of all, for writing that. I was so moved, and also then to hear you read that and to imagine a friend like that. I mean, it sounds like a comic book friend in a way. You know?
Well, that was my model.
Yeah, exactly. But also the creativity. I mean, schools at that time really didn't know what to do with kids like you. But the creativity, the imagination that was at work between the two of you.
Yes. You know, he was a runt. He was tiny. He was fearless. I mean, he didn't take anything from anyone. I mean, all the bullies and the gangs who took money from kids, or lunch money, in order to let us go to school, he liked the fact that I fought back. He thought that's why he was attracted to me. Mm. So together we were left alone because the two of us were just too much. I mean, they would, and his fearlessness, served as a kind of model. And yes, it was an attitude very different from the one I was forging for myself, which was, let's say, had more than a touch of shame and embarrassment involved. So I adopted his. I wonder even now, as I say this, how much a part of this persona I created was influenced by him.
Was that hard for you to read that to us? And I ask that only because you have described the kind of effort that goes into reading. Now, you wrote that, so you're familiar with the words, but was that hard for you to read?
No. You know, I guess that once you write something and once it's, once it's there, it's almost like you've taken all the scariness out of it. It's almost like all the fear is gone. I mean, I have to focus. I have to rehearse. I read this over to myself on my way here. I have to not be surprised. There are times when I give poetry readings where I carefully select poems. I go rehearse them. I try to avoid words I know I have trouble pronouncing. I've had difficulty with it, so it isn't always easy. But after a while, I mean, the music, if I may use that term, of the sounds of the language, which helped me write it, then helped me read it.
You also describe being tutored by somebody, and he asked you, what do you want to be when you grow up? And you said, a writer, and he just burst out laughing. Was that a spontaneous? I mean, do you think as a little boy, this is a little boy that couldn't read, that you wanted to be a writer?
I had no idea I was going to say that. I think I there must have been a very perverse touch of, he was very overweight, and his laughter, I remember he couldn't fit under his desk, and the rollicking laughter, rolls of laughter made him, there was this big booming voice. And he wasn't an unkind man, and I think the last thing he wanted to do was laugh at me, but he saw the irony, just hit him. And sometimes when you try to stop laughing, you laugh all the harder. Mm-hmm. And I sat there trying to figure out why that was so funny. And then he questioned me, and I had no idea that I wanted to be one. Maybe a little of it was perverse on my part that I couldn't. He wasn't being able to teach me. It was the fifth grade. I couldn't be held back another time. And my parents were struggling to afford this. The school demanded I see him. And, I thought about it. I mean, if I could, it was so hard to learn how to read. If I could read, then I could write. And if I could write, then you would become a writer. I mean, why not, right?
Well, and here we are, right? You're a writer who couldn't read as a kid. You also say something, and there's so much of your book you can't see here because I'm down in Philly and you're up in New York, but I've scribbled all over your book and underlined things. But one of the things that you say that really struck me, and as you said, your parents were Polish immigrants, and you write, immigrant and peasant logic, like dyslexic thinking, is a strategy for survival. I underscored that because I'm wondering, as someone with dyslexia, whether you are, in a sense, an immigrant.
Yes. I mean, my father was actually born in, my mother is from Poland, but my father was born in near Minsk in a shtetl, and he was born in Russia, and you could detect an accent there. And yeah, that's a very good observation. Mm-hmm. That yes, their relationship with language. My grandmother, who really was the presence in the house, it was her house we were living in. My father was something of a freeloader, and while starting one business after another, she didn't speak a word of English, and she hid out in accents and various other languages and Yiddish and broken, and I, so here I was struggling with the language I was born to. So yes, there is a kind of peasant logic that goes along with that, or irony.
Both, I think. I mean, because you say my mind even looked down on itself, always apologizing and making excuses for what it couldn't do, perform, or understand. And someone who's, learning English for this first time and wanting to be, part of the culture must feel that as well.
Well, you know, the immigrant story is a ladder, and there's an enormous pressure on the first generation to earn their inheritance. We're placed here in this country, this great, great country, and what our parents and grandparents went through to bring us here is an incredible entitlement and gift. And we're supposed to advance the family, the species, and I wasn't. I just wasn't. I wasn't carrying my weight. My mother, who had been asked to leave school in the 10th grade in order to work and help the family, who desperately wanted to learn to read, was very hurt by this struggle. Here I had done this, and I wasn't appreciating the gift and the advantage I had been given.
You also write that you're about 15 years old, that you fell in love with books, not reading, as you say, but with books. And the book was Walker Percy's The Moviegoer. Now, why that book, do you think?
You know, I read the back of it, and he had won this big prize, the National Book Award for Fiction, and here were all these judges saying all these honorable, you know, really admiring things. And since I was someone who didn't hear much of this or any of it, I try to imagine what it would feel like for somebody to say something like that about me, about writing. And I was already struggling. I was reading. I was passing English courses. I wasn't taking any AP, and I was failing Latin and other things, but I was getting by. And I could read, and this was the first time ever that I picked up a book and bought a book, a paperback, of my own volition and read it. And lucky, lucky me, I happened to pick this book, and there was this first-person voice, and it was great. It was like someone sitting down, and it was like someone who I couldn't imagine would ever bother talking to me. Well-educated, making do, struggling, emotionally honest, this southern, gentlemanly, personality who was so informed and kind. And I fell in love with the idea of the first-person voice, and I wanted to do that. So I think this feeling was somewhat dormant ever since Mr. Joyce. I mean, I don't remember any time saying I wanted to be a writer, but now I wanted to do that. I wanted to make others feel what this writer was making me feel.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. I'd actually love to have you read a couple of poems from your collection of poems called Failure. And Philip Schultz is our guest. We are talking about reading and writing and his new book called My Dyslexia. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Rosenbach Museum and Library supports WHYY and presents Wild New Ways, an exhibit of works by children's book author and illustrator Maurice Sendak. The Rosenbach currently houses over 10,000 of Sendak's original drawings, sketches, prints, and more. The exhibit will provide insight into the artist's fascination with wildlife, from common pets to mythical beasts. Wild New Ways, now on view through January 2012. More information is available online at rosenbach.org.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Just what is President Obama proposing be changed about Medicare to make cuts in the deficit? Also, the Philadelphia choir boy turned rock and roll harpist, now known as Active Child. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Folkways at Gwynedd supports WHYY. Guided by time-honored Quaker values, Folkways is a continuing care retirement community for adults 65 and over. Since 1967, Folkways has been providing its residents with a comprehensive health program and financial stability. Folkways is committed to friendship, caring, and respect as a way of life. For more information or a personal tour, the number is 215-283-7010.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Philip Schultz. He's an award-winning poet. He founded and directs the Writer's Studio in New York, has taught creative writing for years. In fact, his world is largely built around words and language, which has got to be a big surprise to a lot of his teachers. He was considered a non-learner in school, relegated to the dummy class, was held back at times, even expelled from third grade. But when his older son was diagnosed with dyslexia, Schultz realized that he had a similar learning disability, and he's written a new book called My Dyslexia. It is about his experience of dyslexia from the inside out, how his struggles have been so different from his son's, and how he became a poet. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You also write, Philip Schultz, in this book about how someone remarks about your quote-unquote obvious intelligence, and you're just caught up short by this. Do you think of yourself today as an intelligent person, or is there still part of you that's part of the dummy class?
Well, I think both. I mean, I think once a member of the dummy class forever.
And let me say that I was a member of the dummy class as well, but yes, go ahead.
Oh, really?
Yes.
One would never guess. Isn't that interesting?
Yes.
I mean, it's a life, you know, it doesn't cost, well, it costs, the price is emotional, but then you're a lifelong member. It's just, it's kind of like AAA, you know.
Exactly.
It's roadside service anytime you need it, you know.
And membership is pretty cheap every year, so yes. But
oh
anyway,
boy,
yeah,
yes.
we can
well,
make this for a while, but right. Yeah, go ahead.
But, I think that the struggle that went on to reach intelligence or some kind of conscious feeling of being intelligent has been one. I mean, I don't worry about that. I mm-hmm. worry about other things that probably feed back into that. I mean, if I mispronounce a word, or you know, get an idea wrong, or don't articulate something, or there's a long pause and I can't find the word I'm trying to say, an obvious word, then there's a panic, a small panic, and a chain of memories that go a long way back.
So, do you get angry? Do you get frustrated?
Not anymore. Mm. I think I think I understand. You know, I buy it. It's like it's part of the package. And since I like writing poetry and I like other people liking it, I like the process of writing. I've accepted that. I know that you really can't be that stupid if you're going to try to say something in a way that might last for a while, or at least a short while, and others relate to. So after enough of that, I don't, you know, I don't think intelligence is a problem.
Well, I'd love to have you read a poem from a book titled Failure, and this is actually the poem Failure, and I'd love to have you read that for us.
I was 18 when my father died, and he died bankrupt. And the book, at least the title, the idea I thought was about his failure. I discover now with my dyslexia that it's more than that. Failure. To pay for my father's funeral, I borrowed money from people he already owed money to. One called him a nobody. No, I said, he was a failure. You can't remember a nobody's name. That's why they're called nobodies. Failures are unforgettable. The rabbi who read a stock eulogy about a man who didn't belong to or believe in anything was both a failure and a nobody. He failed to imagine the son and wife of the dead man being shamed by each word. To understand that not believing in or belonging to anything demanded a kind of faith and buoyancy. An uncle counting on his fingers my father's business failures, a parking lot that raised geese, a motel that raffled honeymoons, a bowling alley with roving mariachis, failed to love and honor his brother, who showed him how to whistle under cover of steel apples with his right or left hand. Indeed, my father was comical. His watches pinched. He tripped on his pant cuffs and snored loudly in movies where his weariness overcame him, finally. He didn't believe in savings, insurance, newspapers, vegetables, good or evil, human frailty, history, or God. Our family avoided us, fearing boils. I left town, but failed to get away.
I really like that. That's Philip Schultz reading a poem called Failure from a book called Failure, a collection of poems called Failure. Do you think your dyslexia has helped you to be a poet, the kind of poet that you are?
Yes. And I sent my dyslexia book to a friend, a poet, and he wrote back saying that he understood after reading it for the first time where the compassion or the understanding for my father in Failure came.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that's interesting or weird, or because I had never thought about that. And I guess, you know, you struggle so much yourself and live with the idea and accept the fact that you are a failure. I mean, I was a failure, and you know, at the age of 7 and 8 and 9 and 10. So to see my father fail at his stage of the game, at his stage of life, you know, it gave me insight into it. And when I finally was ready, and it took me a long time, I was 60, to write about this, I understood it from my own perspective.
Do you think your dad had dyslexia?
I do. You know, I think that he didn't go, he went to school to the seventh grade. I never saw him read a newspaper. I never looked at a book. I think, you know, he probably did. It is something you inherit. And I think he did. I think that, you know, I have a real feeling for illiteracy, that I understand that. And I also wonder, and I'm saying this for the first time, if there is a connection with some people being embracing their illiteracy because there's reasons, neurological reasons, that they can't learn how to read, and they just accept it. Because I could have easily gone that route, and I think my father did. He would dictate business letters when he was starting a vending business to my mother, who would write them and type them. And there was a fluency and a personality in what he was saying, but he couldn't write it himself. And some of his creativity in creating businesses and personality probably was born of, when you're dyslexic, you can't do this, so you learn to do that. Everything is compensatory. And his whole life was compensatory. He couldn't manage a business once he started it. He didn't know how to figure out books. So they would all go broke. But he was right back there loving to start another one.
And he had a sense of humor, as you do.
Well, thank you. He had a great sense of humor. That was our main form of communication. He laughed. I think that's how he survived. Yeah. I think there was, it would either be laughing or crying all the time.
Something else I can relate to. I've been hogging you to myself, Philip Schultz. Let me get some callers in. And I do want to have you read another poem from Failure as well.
Okay.
But we have Kate joining us from Moorestown. And Kate, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
I interviewed a young man called Kettner Griswold. I wonder if your speaker knows who he is. He went through school very similarly to the speaker, Mr. Schultz, passed up the line by teachers who liked him, but he still couldn't read, undiagnosed dyslexia, of course, was the cause, got into college finally, flunked out his first semester because he couldn't read, was told, go get a job in a car garage somewhere, that's all you're fit for. So he happened to hear about recorded books, got the books, got his first degree, got his master's degree, got his PhD, and became was hired by NASA and became a literal rocket scientist. He designed applications for commercial and scientific projects.
Oh, that's a great story, Kate. Yeah, Philip, go ahead.
the world is full of. I mean, I think that it's very important that people see that there's a, that dyslexia is an advantage. It gives you an edge, that this form of compensatory thinking and struggle makes it that once you get by the anxiety and the struggle and you attack a problem, that you, it's almost easy. It's like working your way through a 300-pound bully and a 200-pound bully, and then there's the 90-pound one, and that's the problem or the issue or the challenge itself, and it's almost easy by the time you get to it. So there are, you know, Einstein was dyslexic, and W.B. Yeats was dyslexic. It goes to Fitzgerald, Scott Fitzgerald. So it goes on. Yes, this is, I don't personally, I don't know, I'm not familiar with his story, but I'm not surprised. I mean, I think that the people who learn and teach themselves to overcome this all this early struggle can be very successful using the tools that they managed and created along the way.
Thanks for calling into Radio Times, Kate. Let's see what Mariska from Easton has to say. Mariska, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you. I wanted to say that listening to the book, I feel as if it is me in a male body, but much older. I started school in 1941, where it was even more difficult, I'm sure, than it was later on in the 50s. And as I was older, I wrote. I wanted to be a writer, and my first paper.
You know what, Mariska? We're going to have to pull you down, and I hate to do that, only because we just don't have a good phone line here. But I'm going to look at the computer. Philip Schultz, and she had a third grade teacher that apparently didn't like her, and you also wrote about some of the teachers that, I don't know if they didn't like you, but they would ignore you.
Well, they didn't know how to deal with me,
exactly.
And they're embarrassed, or there's the story I have that I'm sure that this caller can relate to, that I guess a principal was coming by, and the teacher stuck a book in my hand, and she said, pretend to be reading it when so-and-so comes in. And that's never left me. I can't open a book or give a reading or, you know, at the high holidays, open a prayer book, and I, without feeling, I'm pretending to be reading. And, I'm a fake.
Well, I'd love to have you read actually another poem from your collection, the collection called Failure. And this is the first poem. It's called It's Sunday Morning in Early November.
It's Sunday morning in early November, and there are a lot of leaves already. I could rake and get a head start. The boys' summer toys need to be put in the basement. I could clean it out or fix the broken storm window. When Eli gets home from Sunday school, I could take him fishing. I don't fish, but I could learn to. I could show him how much fun it is. We don't do as much as we used to. And my wife, there's so much I haven't told her lately about how quickly my soul is aging. How it feels like a basement I keep filling with everything I'm tired of surviving. I could take a walk with my wife and try to explain the ghosts I can't stop speaking to. Or I could read all those books piling up about the beginning of the end of understanding. Meanwhile, it's such a beautiful morning, the changing colors, the hypnotic light. I could sit by the window watching the leaves, which seem to know exactly how to fall from one moment to the next. Or I could lose everything and have to begin over again.
Another poem I like very much. Philip Schultz reading a poem from a collection called Failure. That one's called It's Sunday Morning in Early November. You reference your older son, Eli, and your new book, My Dyslexia, is dedicated to him for my son, Eli, and his magical hybrid nature. I like that. What does that mean?
Thank you. Well, it's explained at the very end of the book that dyslexics are this hybrid of so many different things. Like, my son loved the platypus. And it took me forever to figure out that platypus is, you know, like six different animals sewn together into one. The duck and an otter and a snake, around, you know, and it's has a duck's build. And it's just this. And I think dyslexics are, that we take a little of this and a little of that. We can't do this, so we do this. And, you know, he loved the platypus. And that I think that maybe, you know, we all are.
We're all platypi.
And we're all combinations of things that you don't. I remember early on a girlfriend many years ago telling me that she made bread, and I reminded her of pumpernickel. You used all these crazy ingredients that you think can't possibly work, and it comes out pumpernickel. I never knew whether that was a compliment or not.
And where is that girlfriend today, right?
I know, right? I wish her well. She's probably making a famous cook or a famous chef.
Making pumpernickel. Well, Philip Schultz, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure, Marty.
And our guest has been Philip Schultz. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, and he's also written a new book. It's called My Dyslexia, joining us from the NPR studios in New York. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.